My name is Geoffrey Lin. I'm one of the staff here. I'll be taking us through the main part of our service as we sit under God's word. So I'll ask you at this point to take out the leaflet that you were given as you came in. On the inside, there's an outline of the sermon, and also the insert has the Bible passages that are going to be read for us tonight. We're going to have the readings in just a moment. As Michael said, we come to the end of our series, actually. It's our six-week series on 1 Samuel. Now, those who've been here along the way will know that over the first 5 weeks, we got through the first 17 chapters, and you will know that there's 31 chapters in the book, so that only leaves 14 for tonight. Don't worry, we're not going to do them all. We're just going to skim through it and touch down at three key points. Before we do, I thought it'd be helpful just to remind us of the story so far, particularly if you're new amongst us. We're delighted that you're here tonight, but I'm conscious that you're coming at the end of a series. So if you look at the top left of your handout, you can see the story so far. There's two things that you need to know as we come to 1 Samuel and the last of the talks tonight. The first is about the bigger and better story that we belong to. This is the story of the whole Old Testament. And you can see there on the top left, it began back in Genesis with God making a great promise to Abraham that he would bless him, that he'd make him into a great nation, that through him all the peoples of the world will be blessed. That story continues as Moses leads Israel out of slavery in Egypt. That's the Exodus. Then after Israel spends 40 years in the desert, we come to Joshua. And Joshua, who leads Israel finally into the promised land. After Joshua died, unfortunately, in the time of the judges, Israel descended into anarchy. And the hope at the end of that was that perhaps a king might make the difference. And so we come to 1 Samuel, which is why I called the series, as you can see there in the next box, Give Us a King to Lead Us. You'll recall each of the talks that we've seen so far in the series, they're there in that middle box. We began with Hannah. Remember Hannah, the faithful woman of God? In her distress, she turns towards God, not away from him. And in turn, she gives birth to Samuel. Samuel, who is the last judge in Israel, the prophet whose words God never lets fall to the ground. That led eventually to Israel's fateful decision to ask God for a king who would fight their battles for them so they could be like all the other nations. And yet, of course, in that desire, you see the problem. By doing so, Israel is rejecting the God who had already rescued them from slavery in Egypt and had brought them into the promised land. And that, of course, leads then to the tragic failure of Israel's first king, Saul. Saul, who repeatedly disobeys God, as a result of which God says the kingdom will be taken from him and give it to another. So last week we met the next king, the second king of Israel, David. David is the one whom Samuel anoints in private to be Saul's successor. And as the king in waiting, he does what Saul doesn't do. He actually does lead Israel into battle. You recall last week we heard of his great victory over the super soldier Goliath. But what that does is that it leaves us with a problem. The problem is that in Israel there are now two kings. There are two kings in Israel, which is why I've called today's talk Civil War. Civil War. Well, that's the background. As I said, the Bible reading is going to be in three parts. After each of the readings, I'll just make a couple of comments. We're going to start in 1 Samuel chapter 18, and Sarah's going to read for us tonight. So please follow along on your handouts.
As Jeff said, my name is Sarah, and I'm bringing us the Bible reading tonight, so you'll need your handy insert from the leaflet. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Whatever mission Saul had sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully on Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the lyre, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with David, but had departed from Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success, because the Lord was with him. When Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns.
All right, if you look on your handouts, we're on the top right there on point one. Saul grows jealous of David's success and attempts to kill him. Now, straight away, in that first paragraph, verses 1 through 4, we see the problem that there are two kings in Israel. Remember, there's Saul. He's the first and the official king, but he disobeyed God, and so God will take the kingdom for him, and we're just waiting to see when and how. But there's also David. David, who was anointed in private by Samuel to be the second king of Israel, except no one else in Israel knows yet that the kingdom will be his. Now, to further complicate matters, Saul's own son Jonathan and David have become good friends. Now, if you look at verse 3, we're told that Jonathan loved David as himself. And in fact, it goes on to say, did you notice there in verse 4, Jonathan even gives David his own robe, his own tunic, his own sword, his own bow, and his own belt. Do you get what's going on here? Jonathan is the crown prince. He is the heir to Saul's throne, and he is, in a symbolic way, already handing the kingdom over to David. Well, in that middle paragraph, verses 5 through 15, David's military success leads to skyrocketing popularity amongst the people. And in fact, it far outstrips that of Saul's. Look at verse 7. Verse 7, we're told, the people say, "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." Now, it's a little bit bloodthirsty, isn't it? But you get the point. People are basically saying, Saul, good, David, better. Which, of course, is hardly surprising that the people feel that way, because you remember, why did they want a king in the first place? They wanted a king who would fight their battles for them. And that's exactly what David is doing. So, almost inevitable that they will desert Saul and shift their support to David. And so, as Saul grows jealous of David's success, it's almost inevitable that he's going to try and kill this young upstart. You heard what he did. First of all, he throws a spear at him, not once, but twice. And then he starts sending David out on increasingly dangerous missions. In fact, we'll be told in a later chapter that Saul's hope is that David will be killed in battle. Except David goes from strength to strength. Look at verse 14. Verse 14, in everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. The contrast is with verse 12, God has departed from Saul. And so Saul's jealousy and paranoia continues to grow. In fact, did you hear how we were told twice, verse 12 and verse 15, Saul was afraid of David? And yet the section concludes in the way in which it began. Look at verse 16. Verse 16, we're told, all Israel and Judah loved David. All Israel and Judah loved David, which of course is exactly what Jonathan felt at the start of the passage. Okay, so you can see the scene is now set for a confrontation. Confrontation between the two kings of Israel. And that's actually what unfolds in the next part of 1 Samuel. Now, if you look at the bottom left of your handout, you can see a table that gives an overview of chapters 18 through 31. As I said, I'm not going to talk about every chapter, but episodes 2 through 6 take us from chapter 18 through 23. And I just want to briefly summarize it for you before we have our next reading. You can see there at point two, David actually becomes enmeshed with Saul's children. Not only has he befriended Saul's son, Jonathan, he actually ends up marrying Saul's daughter, Michal. In a very real sense, David is being positioned as Saul's successor to his throne. And so point three, eventually, David is forced to flee from Saul. And he takes refuge in the town of Nob. Now that leads a point forward to one of the most horrific incidents in the whole Bible. Here, Saul orders the brutal massacre of the priests of Nob, 85 of his own people, because they aided and abetted David as he tried to flee. It's a measure of just how far Saul will go to try to save his throne. And so, point five, as David goes on the run from Saul, interestingly, he still manages to rescue the Israelite town of Keilah from the Philistines. Remember how the Israelites wanted a king to fight their battles for them? Well, even whilst David is on the run, even whilst he's fleeing for his own life, that's exactly what he does. He still shepherds his people. And so, point six, meanwhile, as Saul continues to pursue David, even enlisting the help of the Ziphites, nevertheless, David manages to escape from Saul. And he does so, interestingly, when Saul is forced to call off his pursuit of David because he hears news that the Philistines have invaded Israel back home. And the point, I think, is that God is orchestrating events behind the scenes to protect David. Well, it all comes to a head in 1 Samuel 24 when the two kings finally meet. So listen in as we have chapter 24 read for us.
After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." With these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. Then David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, "My lord the king." When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say, 'David is bent on harming you'? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lay my hand on my Lord, because he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I am guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hands will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Who are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand." When David finished saying this, Saul asked, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And he wept aloud. "You are more righteous than I," he said. "You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. You have just now told me about the good you did to me. The Lord delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. I know that you will surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear to me by the Lord that you will not kill off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." So David gave his oath to Saul. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold.
All right, thanks, Sarah. So if you turn back to the start of 1 Samuel 24, and on your handout, we're now halfway down at point 7. I don't know why I said this. Dave spares Saul's life. Should be, just be casual. I don't know why I said that, but it should say David. David spares Saul's life. In this episode, that's what we're going to see. David is going to spare Saul's life. Actually, not for the first time and not for the last time either. In the first part, in verses 1 through 7, Saul sees off the Philistine threat, and that means that he's now free to resume his pursuit of David. Saul is even willing to follow David all the way, verse 1, into the desert of En Gedi. That's how far he's willing to go, just to catch him. What unfolds, of course, you heard it read, it's almost comical, really. In verse 2, we're told Saul has taken a posse of 3,000 able young men. So this is a pretty serious manhunt, 3,000 men on his side. But, of course, they don't turn out to be any use to him when Saul leaves his protection detail behind and goes to take a bathroom break in private before the battle begins. That's the part where he goes into the cave to relieve himself. Where, unbeknownst to Saul and his 3,000 able young men, David and his men are hiding at the back of the cave. Now, obviously, this is a pretty big cave. And unsurprisingly, David's men sense, here's a chance to nip it in the bud. Here's a chance to end the war even before it starts. Verse 4, this is what they say, verse 4, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. Here's the problem. And for the record, God never told David to kill Saul. In fact, what we're going to see in the chapters ahead is that even though Saul is trying to kill David, David refuses to lift his hand against God's anointed king. So, of course, the question is, why are David's men urging him to kill Saul at this moment? Now, obviously, at one level, there's self-interest. If David kills Saul, then they can leave the desert and go home. But there was also a hint, I think, back in chapter 23, where God used the same phrase, but with respect to the Philistines. So I printed the passage there for you on your handout, halfway down on the right, 1 Samuel 23, verse 4. Once again, David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered him, go down to Keilah, for I am going to give the Philistines into your hand. I'm going to give the Philistines into your hand. It's almost exactly the same thing as what David's men say to him here in chapter 24. Because in the eyes of David's men, the Philistines and Saul are both enemies of David, and therefore David is entitled to treat them however he wants. Except that's not how David sees it. Look at verse 6. Verse 6, David said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord. And in fact, David says exactly the same thing again in verse 10, this time to Saul himself. And of course, there's a great irony, isn't there? David refuses to lift his hand against Saul, who is trying to kill David, who is also the Lord's anointed. As I said, so there's no mistaking David's intention. We're going to see this is not the only time that David shows mercy to Saul. He's going to spare Saul's life again in chapter 26. Which means I think what we're being told here is that David is the kind of king that Old Testament Israel needs. See, Israel doesn't need someone to fight their battles for them. They don't need someone to give them what they want. What they need is a king who will lead them in the way in which God would have them live. Because the whole point is, of course, they are completely unlike all the other nations. Or to put it slightly differently, and in language that makes more sense to us, because here in Australia we're not in a monarchy, so we don't have a king really. Actually, we do. That's not... we don't really. You know what I'm saying. David is a leader who is not driven by popularity contests or opinion polls. He does what God would have him do, not what the people say. Well, as I said, the whole episode, actually, it's almost comedic, it's almost farce. I mean, can you imagine? David is creeping up behind Saul as Saul, this sounds a bit crass, as Saul is standing at a urinal, and somehow, without being noticed, he cuts off a corner of his robe and he sneaks away. Now, the passage doesn't answer a whole bunch of the questions, right? Like, how on earth did he manage to do this? But when David tells Saul in verses 8 through 15 that he has just spared his life, actually, Saul professes to have a change of heart. Saul says, yes, he will change his ways. And in fact, by the end of the third paragraph, verses 16 through 22, it seems a truce has been negotiated. Maybe the civil war is over, even before it's got going. Yet, of course, we readers who've made our way through all of 1 Samuel, we can't help but wonder if Saul's contrition is genuine or not. And given Saul's track record, do you think he's actually changed his mind? Do you think he is really going to reform his behaviour? Do you think that Saul's just accepted, oh yes, the kingdom will now go to David? Of course, when I put it like that, you know the answer is probably not. And that's exactly what happens. In fact, there's a hint in verse 22 that that's what's going to take place. Look at verse 22. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. It suggests, I think, that David still doesn't feel safe around Saul. And actually, that's what unfolds then in the rest of chapters 25 through 30. If you go back to the left-hand side and you can see the breakdown of what happens next, this is episodes 8 through 13. Let me just briefly summarize what happens before we come to our last reading. Point 8, the next thing that happens is that David marries Abigail. Now, we've not met Abigail until this point, but Abigail is the widow of one of Saul's very wealthy and powerful supporters. It's a sign, actually, that the balance of power in Israel is shifting from the first king, Saul, to the second king, David. And yet at point 9, when the Ziphites again betray David to Saul, we discover that, well, surprise, surprise, Saul hasn't changed his mind. He is still trying to kill David, but again, David escapes. And again, David spares Saul's life. This time what David does is that he creeps into Saul's camp one night, unnoticed, and he steals Saul's spear and water jug from his bedside table. Once again, though, Saul claims to be contrite. And I think by now David is just completely fed up. And so here's what's remarkable. At point 10, David then is forced to take refuge amongst the Philistines. Isn't that deliciously ironic? David feels safer amongst Israel's enemies, the Philistines, Goliath's people. David feels safer there than he does amongst God's people, Israel, while Saul is on the throne. And so, point 11, when the Philistines mass for war again against Israel, Saul at this point has got a dilemma. Saul asks the Lord for guidance, but he doesn't receive any answers. So, in desperation, and this is almost... it's almost absurd. Saul then consults a medium, that is, he conducts a seance to try and bring Samuel back from the dead to tell him what to do, to which Samuel simply confirms for Saul that God's judgment, it's about to fall, that God's patience has run out. But as the battle is about to begin between Israel and the Philistines, you remember David is technically on the Philistine side at the moment. And that's obviously going to be a problem. Because remember, David has said he will not lift his hand against Saul, against the Lord's anointed. But miraculously, on the eve of the battle, the Philistines stand him down. Once again, I think what we're seeing is God's providential hand at work, because now David won't be forced to fight against Saul. And the only other episode in 1 Samuel is there at point 13. After he's cut loose by the Philistines, David defeats the Amalekites, which completes the task that Saul was meant to have done back in chapter 15, but did not. All right, that brings us to our last reading then. And here we see the final battle between Saul and the Philistines. Thanks, Sarah.
Now the Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell dead on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines were in hot pursuit of Saul and his sons, and they killed his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor-bearer was terrified and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day. When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons had died, they abandoned their towns and fled. And the Philistines came and occupied them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his armor, and they sent messages throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among their people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths and fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. When the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men marched through the night to Bethshan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days.
Alrighty, thank you, Sarah. So on your handout on the bottom right, we're at point 14. Saul is defeated by the Philistines. Saul's final demise has been a long time coming, but it's still tragic. Ever since chapter 15, when Saul rejected God, who in turn rejected him as king over Israel. And in fact, throughout the rest of 1 Samuel, as Saul repeatedly tries to kill David, God's anointed king in waiting, Saul has kept disobeying God time and time again to the very end. And the contrast, of course, throughout has been with David who will not lay his hand on God's king Saul. What's most striking, I think, about chapter 31 is that when it comes to Saul's death, did you notice there is no mention of God at any point? No mention of God? It's as if to emphasize that God's judgment on the house of Saul is final and complete. And the other thing that isn't mentioned in chapter 31, there's no mention of David either. Did you notice that? As if to emphasize that David's hands are clean over the death of the Lord's anointed Saul. The only dignity afforded to King Saul in his death is that the people of Jabesh-Gilead retrieve his headless body. I remember, actually, Saul's very first act as king back in chapter 11 was to rescue the people of Jabesh-Gilead. And yet, 1 Samuel ends with the king of Israel, Saul, dead, and the Philistines in the ascendancy. And if you want to know what happens next in this bigger and better story that we're following, well, normally I'd say come back next week, but actually I'm going to say tonight, come back in August. What we're going to do next week is we're going to take a slight break from 1 Samuel and we're going to spend the next 6 weeks in Galatians, and Bernie's going to be preaching for us throughout that time. But we are going to come back to 2 Samuel where you can see from the title of today's talk, I called it Civil War Part 1 because it's not yet over. Well, so what for us? Let me make just three brief reflections or observations as we wrap our series on 1 Samuel for this part of our year. And you can see the three things I want to say there. They're each printed on your handout. Firstly, what we learn from Saul, this is about what not to do. Remember that when God rejected Saul as king over Israel, God did not reject Saul entirely. Samuel was still willing to worship with Saul even. And yet for the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, time and time again, Saul continues to disobey God. The best example of all, of course, is the fact that he's trying to kill David, who is God's anointed king. What we learn, I think, from the demise of Israel's first king is that sin hardens our hearts. It is addictive and it accumulates, and the more we succumb to sin, the harder it is to stop. I'll say it again. What we learn from Saul is that sin hardens our hearts. It is addictive. It accumulates, And the more we succumb, the harder it is to stop. So tonight, what I want to say is, please repent now. And please seek help if you need it to put sin to death. Second thing I want to say, what do we learn from David? And this, more to the point, is about what to do, as opposed to what we saw with Saul and what not to do. My reflection, particularly on the second half of 1 Samuel, is that David's refusal to lay his hand on the Lord's anointed throughout this entire civil war, it is remarkable. I mean, if there was ever a justification for David taking matters into his own hands, surely it's the fact that Saul is trying to kill him in the first place. And yet, David will not. David won't listen to his own men when they urge him to end Saul. I mean, that makes David the kind of leader that we long for. And David doesn't try to convince himself that, well, if Saul manages to kill David, then David would never become king, so surely God would want him to take preemptive strike. David doesn't do that either. What we learn from David, I think, is that his willingness to trust God's promises, even when he can't see how they can be fulfilled. God has told him the kingdom will come to him, but it will be in God's timing, not his own. The kingdom will come to him in God's way, not his own. And so, without David becoming passive or fatalistic or just giving up trying, David knows that he can leave it up to God because he knows that God's will be done, even when it doesn't feel like it possibly could. I want to say that that's really hard for the activists amongst us to hear. That God's will be done in his timing, in his way. And yet here's the thing. Even if that's the lesson we take from David's example about what to do, the problem is that in 2 Samuel, we're going to discover that David is every bit as bad as the first king Saul. So here's the final reflection for us, down the bottom of your handout. What we learn about God and what he is like in 1 Samuel. Let me say that some things that we learn about God in 1 Samuel are pretty hard to come to terms with. On the one hand, God both chooses Saul and rejects him. What does that make us think about? Well, actually, can we take God at his word? This is the reason why throughout this series I've been urging you to come along to Deep Dive. There's a note there on your handout and there's also a slide on screen. It's on this Thursday night and we're going to try and wrestle with this exact question. Does God change his mind? All the details are about that are on the front of your leaflet, but do join us if you can here on Thursday night. What do we learn about God though in 1 Samuel? Well, what I think we learn in chapters 18 through 31, in this last part in particular, is that God is still sovereign. God is still sovereign. God's purposes will be fulfilled, and his plans will never fail. And God's kingdom will come. His will be done. God's name will be hallowed, exalted, glorified to the ends of the earth. David will be king, as God intended. And again, we've seen God work in unexpected and unanticipated ways that showcase his power and his control. Think back about some of the things we've seen just in this last part of 1 Samuel. And we saw that David was helped to escape from Saul by the help of Saul's own son, Jonathan. We saw David find refuge from Saul amongst Israel's very enemies, the Philistines. We saw Saul forced to call off his pursuit of David when he hears of the Philistines invading Israel. And when the Philistines stand David down from their battle, actually David is spared from having to face Saul, which he wouldn't have done anyway. Ultimately, Saul is killed, but not by David, by the Philistines. So to the very end, David's hands are clean. What we learn, I think, from 1 Samuel is that God is still sovereign. Actually, that's the way 1 Samuel began. Do you remember how it started? Right back at the very beginning of 1 Samuel, we saw God's sovereignty over the lives of individual people in Israel. Remember Hannah in her childlessness, whose prayer God heard? Well, now where it's going to finish in chapter 31 is with us seeing that God is also Lord over all the nations of the world. Because through all the ups and downs, God is still writing his bigger and better story. He really is. A climax to that story is when God appoints a king, not just for the Jews, a king who will be Lord of all the nations of the world. God is still writing his bigger and better story. Now, I know that it's hard for us to see at times. It's hard to see in our individual lives. It's even harder to see when we look at the world around us on a global scale. But please don't give up on God, because he hasn't given up on us. Even though, to be perfectly honest, he's had every reason to do so by now. God is still sovereign. And I want to say that that's actually how you think about tomorrow and this week ahead. You know, I don't know what's going to happen in anyone's life tomorrow. None of us do, of course. I can't see the future. I don't know what's going to happen. But whether it's struggles or joys, both of which are real, but both of which are fleeting, God is still sovereign. And if Jesus has gone to such extraordinary lengths to gather his people, he will be enthroned forever and will be with him. So speed on that day, I say. I'm going to ask to finish our time today by praying. And we're going to pray a prayer that expresses our confidence and trust that God is still in control. So would you join me? The prayer is going to be on screen. Together. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For the kingdom, the power, and the glory are yours, now and forever. Amen.